Welcome to this week's edition of Rational Radio. Cracking show coming up. Unfortunately, markets under more pressure. COVID-19 is getting its grip, getting its teeth into the investment community as well as in South Africa. But we'll be finding out the best way to handle all of this in just a moment. As always, it's a warm welcome to David Shapiro as we kick off the show with a market that's down about 6%, 5.5%, 6% today, Dave.
At the moment, the All Share Index down about 5%. Yeah, but metals down 9%, 10%, and industrials as well. So it's been a widespread sell-off. You know, I watch 80 shares, which are the largest cap, carefully. I watch those on a spreadsheet, and all 80 are down at the moment. So it's that kind of day, Alec. It's very difficult.
David, did you see the trading statement that came out from Famous Brands? There's so much on SENS about the different companies that are implementing different issues, but
I see it now.
And really what they're up to is they're saying they're going to look after their food delivery, they're going to practice social distancing and so on. But when we spoke with the Croniers in China, they said when they wanted to get to go out to eat, they had to sit at different tables. So I don't think we quite got to that point in South Africa yet.
Not at all. I think, you know, I was in Melrose Arch over the weekend just to go buy supplies and that. And I parked down there and I looked in at the restaurants, and there were the odd table where people were dining. And most of the restaurants were open, but very, very few people around. I went into Woolworths. Woolworths, strangely enough, was stocked. But there again, no more than a handful of people at the tills. Normally, there are a lot more, certainly on a weekend. So people are avoiding each other and not wanting to go out. So I think the message is getting through.
Well, let's bring in Grace Harding now. She's the chief executive of Ocean Basket. Grace, lovely to have you on the program today. What David says about people not going out to restaurants, are you seeing it? Are you seeing a similar situation?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I think our sales over the weekend were about 58% down. And up until the other day, I was still thinking about, gee whiz, what are we going to do to keep the trade going, to keep the customers coming in? And then I woke up this morning and I thought, well, I guess we need to get some advice from our forefathers, because it feels like it is World War III with different ammunition. And as a restaurant group, obviously eating out is not a necessity like toilet paper, which has become number one on the list, apparently. But we definitely are seeing a massive decline.
Grace, it was interesting to read through the Famous Brands statement, them being listed in the stock market there and having UK operations as well. They say that in the UK, it was on the 1st of March that their sales started plummeting. In South Africa, 16th of March. So it's about a two-week gap between the two. Has the 16th also been a day, a red-letter day, poor red-letter day for you?
Yeah, I think the trends in everything is that South Africa's 2 weeks behind. I mean, we hear that we're even 2 weeks behind in terms of the impact of the virus ramping up. But I can say very, very similar.
And how bad is it, or how much of a difference is it from, say, the 1st of March?
Night and day. Like, you can't even compare it. It's a bit like you went to bed and things were starting to look very strange around this virus, and then you woke up and the guns were outside your door. That's how different it was.
David,
and what was so weird is that January and February were great months. They really, really were. So it was just really, it feels like we've been hijacked, you know, by a big bad virus.
It's an interesting point in bringing David back in again. I spoke with Hendrik de Toy, Dave, on Friday, and he said that from an investment perspective, it's almost like war has been declared. He said it's like a war economy. The governments are going to have to spend as they do in wartime without any thought. So interesting to hear Grace mentioning a moment ago that it feels like we've gone to war as well. Is that the way you're reading it?
It is. In fact, one investment man described it as World War III. He says, but it's going to be a 90-day World War III. It's exactly like that. People have gone into hiding. I think, you know, where it's different, though, you haven't got the human spirit. We're all alone. We're all sitting by ourselves with our wives, with our families. Yes, it's bringing families together again. But in those times, even in war times, you could go out, you could see neighbors. There was closer communication between families, or, you know, families and friends. You could sit round and talk about things. I think this is the difference here, and this is what makes it psychologically so different, is that, you know, you walk past someone in the street and you don't want to greet them just in case they cough or splutter. You know, you want to keep your distance, and that for me is a very strange thing. They're closing down parks and nobody wants to run or be next to somebody else. So we're going into a totally different environment now, which is so antisocial and understandably so.
Well, antisocial, I guess, excepting there is social media, which would make things a bit easier. But just in the real world, Grace, in your world, what about your staff? Presumably you gear up for the same kind of numbers that you had in January, February. You can't just tell all your staff to go home, or can you?
Yeah. So we're working on a few priorities. The first is people come first. And I guess this is when we're lucky that we're not a public company, because we can make decisions that, I guess, are driven by our shareholders. And the first thing our shareholders said to us is, Grace, the people come first. It doesn't matter what happens to our investment, which is absolutely mind-boggling. And that's the way it should be, in my mind. So that's the first point. The second thing is, we are a franchise business. We have seen all our restaurants shut down all over the world. So Cyprus restaurants, we actually own those. Those are the only restaurants we own. They shut down. Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Oman, Dubai, Mauritius. So zero income coming in from them. So it's about people, our own head office people. We are still going to be paying their salaries. We're okay for a while. We don't know how long this war is going to take. I heard you say 90-day war. Gee whiz, from your lips to everyone's ears, that it's a 90-day war.
If
the restaurant staff is more
90,
challenging.
Grace, if it is 90 days, are you guys able to see it through?
Yes, 100% we are. The restaurants are a challenge. You know, some restaurant owners obviously are not as frugal as others, and everyone has different conditions, but we started communicating with our restaurants literally on the 18th of March, and we're doing everything to support them. We haven't charged any royalties and marketing in March already. We stopped it, even though we had half a month of decent trade. So we are able to do what's best for the longevity of the brand and the well-being of the people. And then the other thing we're implementing is, we're starting up our own little school, because we either use the war analogy or the delay of the Olympics analogy, and we know that we will run one day and we will remain fit. So we're developing a whole curriculum of things that we want people to learn, from improving Excel sheets to understanding GPs, waste management, all sorts of things. And everyone in our community is going to be encouraged to learn. And then obviously the sort of the office workers and us who have to run the business, we are really, really busy.
Grace, what about dark kitchens? We know there has been a trend in the whole fourth industrial revolution to more convenience foods. Can your franchisors not just change things around and start producing for the takeaway market?
Well, look, we already have kitchens, so it doesn't matter whether, look, and at the moment they're dark anyway. So we believe that, yes, some people are still doing takeaways. That's going to drop because everyone's going to hold on to their cash. I mean, how many people already have sort of scaled down their lifestyle, not only sort of middle management or blue-collar workers? So I don't know what these dark kitchens are going to do, because how many people are going to carry on spending X amounts a month on this luxury product? So we do have restaurants. They do have kitchens. They are able to deliver. They are able to do takeaways. And I don't believe that that business is going to thrive.
All right. So even on the restaurant side, you've No, we seem to have a bit of a problem there on the line. Just very briefly, yes. On the restaurant side, you've seen, a drop of 58% just in the last couple of days. But on the takeaway side, there hasn't been an increase on the other end.
No, I think there was a little burst on Uber Eats. We haven't got the stats from the other delivery companies. When I get them, I'll share them with you. I'll just pop you a mail. But if there has been a burst, Alex, I do believe it's short-lived.
Grace Harding, the chief executive of Ocean Basket, bringing us up to date there. Okay, Mr. Shapiro, we've seen that the markets struggled a little bit this morning. Getting back to that war analogy, if it's a 90-day war, you would look at things differently. If this war continues for longer than 90 days, then one has to maybe conserve cash at all costs. Why do you think that 90 days could be the term?
Maybe I'm too optimistic, or maybe I've been around too long. But the one thing about markets is that once they begin to discount the bad news, people start to look differently at share prices or at life. And I think we've seen the worst in the news. In other words, there's no more shock value. I call it shock value in that we know it's around. We know we're going to lockdown. We know all of that. You know, when Goldman Sachs comes out and says, oh, the U.S. economy is going to be 30% down, we know that. We closed the world down. So what do you expect? You know, we don't expect anything else. So that kind of news is not really forcing us out anymore. It's only the marginal players that are saying, okay, let's get out now. So I would imagine we're going to start seeing the signs of a bottoming of the market. It's not going to feel like that. You know what I mean? It's not going to feel like that to you. But that's why I say we're probably closer to the end than the beginning. And also, after a few months or after a few weeks of this, Alec, people start to say, hold on a sec, I can't stay, hold up. You know, I'm going to get out. I'm going to start doing things. And they look at ways in which to get their life back in normal. So they will start to go to Grace's restaurant or start the Uber Eats and start spending and trying to improve the lifestyle that they're leading. And I'll come to other things as we talk as well. So I'm saying, hold on a sec. Don't position yourself for disaster. Rather, try and position yourself for what things are going to look like when this ends.
Isn't it just the right thing to do now is not to try and catch any falling knives and not to throw good money potentially after bad, but just to sit on the sidelines, as you've been advising actually over the last couple of weeks, and just wait for things to settle?
Right. Exactly right, you know, and look for opportunities. Start thinking about your portfolio and where you want to be. What will the world look like? I don't think it's going to change. I think we're going to go back to where we are, although I think that when I say go back to where we are, I still think the same economy will prevail. I've been a big believer in the tech economy. Alec, when I see you in your studio, and I mean sitting there, doing very good radio, but you're handling everything. Remember the old days where you had Sunshine and you had a whole lot of production teams, etc.
Yeah, and Dominic and Janine and everyone in the back end organizing interviews.
Yourself.
Yeah.
So just think about that. Just think about how conditions have changed and how we're embracing this so-called data economy. And I think it's going to prevail. And I think that the big tech companies are still going to forge ahead. They've got plenty of money. They're going to continue with their R&D, research and development, looking for new products. I think we're going to see massive changes in health and healthcare and pharmaceuticals. So I'm saying, hold on, there's going to be plenty of opportunity for us to make up the kind of losses that we have at the moment.
Now, here's a theory, one that I have to ascribe to Hendrik de Toy, who, by the way, his company, 91, can you believe that the bad luck about their listing? Today it's down 17% again. It's at 24 and 50.
And Hendrik has worked so hard to get this company off the ground. He's worked so hard in the Investec stable, etc. And for him and for his staff who wanted to go alone, who saw, you know, that's been their strategy. They felt that they should be apart from the bank. And just to see their shares tumble like this and the business so difficult to pick up is very disheartening. But listen, Hendrik's been through a few himself. He started in 1991, so I can name at least 6 or 7 downturns that he's already experienced. So he's hardened and will pick up from where he is at the moment.
The point he made, though, was in a war economy, the governments don't care about restraining their spending, because they shouldn't. And what's the point in restraining your spending? And the Germans have actually taken over the country, or you're talking German in a year's time. And we have, well, germs, not Germans this time, that if you don't spend, if you don't fight back against it in a war economy, you're going to capitulate to a different enemy. Is that, though, in the long term, not sowing seeds for inflation, for escalation in asset prices, simply because there'll be just so much more money around?
I hope so. You know what I mean? I'm not scared about it. That doesn't scare me. And I think that once we do get inflation, if we do get inflation, remember we said the same thing in 2007, 2008, 2009 about inflation. We were dead scared that these policies that Bernanke was increasing would send inflation through the roof. We haven't seen it in 10 years, and we're probably not going to see it. I don't understand it. I don't think economists understand it. So I don't think at this point inflation is an issue. You know what the point is? When you listen to Grace, the point is that we've got to make sure that her business survives. That's what the point of government is, to make sure that these businesses, the plants, the remain intact, that you continue to remain to maintain your productive capacity, and that your workers, you don't throw away workers who've got skills and whom you've trained. And that's the point. That's where government has got to come in, and they've got to do whatever they can. They've got to get cash to places like Grace's company. They've got to say to her, what do you need to survive over the next 3 months so that you don't go down the tubes, that we don't lose your business? Whether we've got that in South Africa, I don't know. But that's the point that the UK is trying to do, that Europe's trying to do, that that the US is trying to do. That's their aim and motivation.
David, you knew Sol Kerzner, the late Sol Kerzner. He passed away Saturday night. I guess there aren't too many South African businessmen who have made quite the imprint that he did on the world.
No, I remember him very well, because I actually spent my honeymoon, which was in 1971, at Beverly Hills. And that was his first venture into luxury hotels. And from then on, of course, Sol's name became known. You know, here was this man who I think his parents owned some hotels down in Durban. I don't remember his history. But, I mean, from then on, you know, what Sol did, there wasn't a year that went by where he didn't do something exceptional. And he took on the world, you know, by saying taking on the world, the $1 million at Sun City. Mm. He was the first person. I mean, there was just so many. Well, and a very, very colorful man.
Well, we've got the right person to give us insights into Sol, and we cross to London now, or to the UK anyway, to Ian Douglas. Ian, how long were you and Sol friends, and, well, how long did you work for him?
Yeah, morning, Alec. It's nice to be on your show. I worked for Sol for just 20 years, but, I mean, I knew him for much longer than that. I knew him, you know, for probably, you know, most of my adult life. I, in fact, remember very clearly when the first time I actually saw him was when he was walking into the Sun City main sort of foyer there, the very impressive foyer down by the casino, with Annalene Creel on his arm after the Frank Sinatra concert. And I think that was in about 1979.
Well, then David's honeymoon would have been a few years before that. Do you remember that early history? Sol's parents, did they own hotels?
Yes, I do. Yes, absolutely. No, I know the history well. Yes, his parents, in fact, they came out to South Africa in the 30s from what was then Poland, or, you know, sort of, you know, just kind of between Poland and Russia. and they settled in South Africa. And then, you know, Sol was born in 1935. So, you know, 84, as you said in your previous remarks. And they actually ran a cafe in Bears Valley in the area, you know, south of Joburg, which was a rough neighborhood in which Sol grew up. But they owned hotels, a couple of hotels. The first hotel they purchased the lease on was a hotel called the Menorah, obviously the Menorah from the Jewish faith, the candle, as you know. And that was a tiny hotel. And then they purchased something called the Palace Hotel. But Sol's real first sort of break, as it were, was in 62 when he bought the lease on what was called the Astra Hotel in Durban, which was a small hotel, but which he started the first sort of proper nightclub, offering in Durban, which was called the Talk of the Town. And that was in 62.
Is it still around, the Astra?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's probably been converted into some kind of residential development now. It's behind all the other hotels that he built, you know, such as the El Amgeni, the Maharani, etc., on the Durban beachfront.
Yeah, what used to be called the Golden Mile. I'm sure they still call it the Golden Mile in Durban.
Correct. Yeah. I think that's right.
How come Sol went into accountancy first off? Because if you just traced his background, were his parents keen to, as immigrants often are, to give him an education in inverted commas? Is that why he became a CEO?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, he was apparently a very diligent student. That's what he used to tell me. He was looking for a solid profession, as so many, you know, young kids were in those days, and went off and started chartered accountancy at WITS, and, you know, graduated and went to accounting firm called Walpert and Abrams, which was a, you know, one of the leading Durban firms. Durban, as you know, of course, at that time was the, you know, the sort of place to be. Cape Town at that point in South Africa's history was kind of not really that well celebrated, not that well known. Durban was where everyone went from Johannesburg. And he was with Walpert and Abrams for a few years, and I think, you know, just clearly decided he wanted to get into hospitality. And that was when he made the move to lease the Astra. And then the first venture, of course, the Beverly Hills, which was opened in 64, December of 64, in Umhlanga Rocks. Now, I remember Umhlanga Rocks at that time, Alec, was, you know, cane fields, sugar cane fields. There was nothing out there. And he saw this piece of land, which was next to, you know, sort of seaside weekend cottage type thing. And he decided that that was where he was going to build, you know, South Africa's first five-star hotel, 90 rooms. He went overseas one trip. I think he allowed himself one trip, and he flew to Miami, or through New York to Miami. He always used to tell the very famous story that he was in the elevator in one of the buildings in New York. And in those days, of course, they had elevator ladies who used to operate the elevators. And this lady was in tears, floods of tears. And he asked her, you know, what's wrong? You know, can I help? And she said, no, our president has just been shot. And that was, of course, Kennedy, who was shot around that time. I don't remember the exact date. But he went on this trip and he basically explored what he thought were the leading hotels of that sort of seaside location of Miami and Florida. And he came back and he built what he felt was his version of that to bring five-star luxury to South Africa.
Incredible that he way ahead of his time in so many respects, but in that way too. Nowadays, if we want to build something in this country, we do go and look internationally. He was very driven, though. Talking to everybody's got their Sol Kersner stories. So, talking to people who worked for him, it was not unusual to get a 2 a.m. phone call from Mr. Kersner to say, "I need to meet with you now." Where did this come from?
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, he was very driven. He was a guy who, you know, had a temper. It was well known he had a temper. But the great thing about Sol was that you always knew where you stood from him. somebody once said to me, you know, you're in trouble when Saul stops talking to you. Because, you know, he was always just very engaged and always on top of all the detail. And if he stopped talking to you, he clearly had written you off and was going to move on. But yes, he used to call people at all times of the night. He was, you know, he's a guy who got his hands very dirty. I mean, he used to be on the site, at, you know, whatever, 5 a.m. or midnight, what have you. And, that was the way he worked. He didn't seem to have much need for sleep like some of the other, you know, great leaders of the world. And he, you know, he used to just keep going. He, of course, was drinking quite heavily at the time, but, you know, he gave up alcohol and cigarettes when he was about 70 and was teetotal for the rest of his life.
He comes from a working-class background, as you've explained, Bears Valley, pretty tough those days. He was also fairly short. I remember meeting him a few times
right.
I'm not sure what, 5'6" or so, but
probably about 5'6", 5'7", something like that, yeah.
But as a result, he must have been picked on, I guess, as kids do. And then he took up boxing. And I love that saying that you, in the incredible eulogy that you guys put together, that Saul would say, keep boxing on or just box on.
Yeah, you got to box on. Yeah, you got to box on. I mean, you're right. He was well known for that expression. And he was one of those guys who, you know, it was a bit of a dichotomy in a way because, you know, he played in the symphony orchestra in Johannesburg when he was a kid. And at the same time, you know, took up boxing and became the welterweight champion of Wits University. He always used to say he took up boxing out of self-defense. He grew to love the sport. You know, he thought it was one of his great passions. And he used to, you know, do a lot of boxing fights with a very good friend of his, a very close friend, one of his best friends, Bob Arum, the legendary Bob Arum of Top Rank. But he was certainly one of those guys who certainly came from, you know, the more difficult side of the tracks or the rough side of the tracks and made good. And I think that was a great thing about Saul. He kind of never really forgot his background or his origins. He was, you know, someone who, some of his best friends were the guys that he was at school with or in the army with, and they remained his friends till his dying day.
He also, you mentioned Bob Arum, who I think most South Africans of a more mature age would remember brought world boxing to this country, even
correct,
champions in Gerrie Coetzee. But he is also incredibly well connected elsewhere. When you mention names like Frank Sinatra, Freddie Mercury,
right,
Elton John,
right,
Shirley Bassey, Liza Minnelli, he knew them all very well and managed to bring them to what was then a very isolated South Africa.
Yeah, that's right. He knew them all. He you know, liked to spend time with them, and I think they liked to spend time with him. And you know, Bob Arum is still today working in boxing. It's quite a remarkable story. He's over 80, and he's just one of those guys that keeps on going. And he's working with his son in the business, I think, and it's going really well. But yes, he knew a lot of famous people, and he made it his business to know them, and you know, brought them out, as you said, to South Africa in groundbreaking events. David, your previous guest was mentioning the $1 million. I mean, when the $1 million started, $1 million was a huge sum of money. There was no other golf tournament in the world that offered that sort of prize money. And, you know, that was Saul's genius. The story behind the $1 million is an interesting one, though, because it was actually Lee Trevino, who was a friend of Saul's, who said to him, you know, if you really want to kind of get yourselves on the map, if you want people to know where South Africa is and where Sun City is, offer a prize of $1 million. And that was what he did.
Fascinating. He always thought bigger than everyone else. When he built the Lost City, it was, well, Sun City itself, but then the Lost City was a huge amount of money, I recall, over R1 billion for those days. What was it about him? How can the rest of us lesser mortals learn from someone who somehow just didn't seem to have any limits to his ambitions and dreams?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it was one of those things where Saul, you know, dreamed big, but it was also practical. I mean, he had a real grasp of the numbers. So it wasn't just fantasy stuff and, you know, somebody writing big checks. He really sort of, you know, understood what drove people. He understood, I think, what true hospitality meant. And he did his homework. So, you know, I think, look, you can never deny the fact that the Palace of the Lost City was a leap of faith. But I think, you know, when Saul did a project like that, he always said, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to get the best people in the world to work with me on this. And he'd bring in talent and, you know, he'd create something that was unique, that was memorable, and he'd executed exceptionally well. And I think, you know, that's the story. I think it's being able to combine that huge vision with being able to execute on the detail and making sure that you can, you know, combine those two really key ingredients for any successful business.
Yeah, I've seen that with great business entrepreneurs time and again. They know the big stuff, but they also understand the detail. You did mention Bob Arum's working with his son. From Saul's right. point of view, when his son died, and Butch was extremely highly rated by pretty much everybody. I remember talking to people after he died in 2006, and he was hugely regarded as really walking in his father's footsteps. Did that knock his dad back?
Yeah, I think, you know, nobody ever recovers from the loss of a child. It's an awful thing, you know, to happen. And what was, I had the privilege of working with Butch as well. And, you know, Butch was a remarkably good foil to his dad. They had some similarities, but they complemented each other so wonderfully. And you're right. He was a very talented guy and he was, you know, in a very promising career in corporate finance, working, I think it was Lehman Brothers. It wasn't Lehman Brothers. I think it was one of the big companies in the States, and Saul persuaded him to come and work for him and join him. And he then became CEO of the company, and he had been CEO of the company for 2 years when he was killed in a helicopter smash in 2006 in the Dominican Republic. I was at the time in Singapore, which I think is an interesting story as well, because it demonstrates Saul's grit and determination. I was working on the bid that we were putting together for the Singapore casino license, which we subsequently lost, unfortunately. But Saul literally, you know, went to New York, buried his son in New York, and got on a plane and flew across the world for 26 hours. To get to Singapore to come and make the presentation to the government on the submission that we had made. And, you know, he was one of those guys who he said, I want to do this for Butch. Butch believed in this project and I wanted to get it done. And that was the determination of this remarkable man.
Extraordinary man, extraordinary story, not without controversy. As I mentioned on Biz News, that I went off all the way to Mauritius to interview him in 1994. About the controversy about alleged corruption with, I think it was Kaiser Matanzima and Transcar. What did he told me he completely denied that there was anything to it. What did he say to you guys about the way that he was continuously targeted on that?
Yeah, look, I think he was, it was something that got to him. It was something that upset him. But it was something that I think, you know, he was ultimately, redeemed from, in the sense that, you know, Chris Turnell, the Attorney General of the Transkei, formally dropped all those charges against Saul Kersner in 1997. I think what's important as well, Alec, is to say that, you know, Saul went on after those allegations to be licensed around the world to operate casinos. He was licensed in the UK and he was licensed in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which is known in the casino industry to be the toughest jurisdiction in the world to get licensed. So, you know, what I'm saying is that if you get licensed in Atlantic City by the Casino Control Commission of the state of New Jersey, you know, they've gone through the detail and they've gone through the stuff and they've clearly satisfied themselves that there's nothing there because they don't take any chances on this stuff.
For sure.
So I think that's an important point to make on this on this thing. And I think it was sad that it kept on going. I think South Africa was going through a challenging time, and there were clearly a lot of different points of view on this. But I think that was where it ended up.
Yeah, and I went through something similar when I joined the board of Pumalela, which was in the gaming field, much, much smaller, obviously, than Atlantic City. But you don't get those licenses if you aren't, pretty squeaky clean. Yeah. He did die in South Africa, so clearly that didn't alienate him from the land of his birth.
No. His soul was spending a huge amount of time in South Africa, right through his life. And he at no stage ever stayed away. He loved South Africa. He loved the rugby, he loved the cricket, and all that South Africa represented. He came back, he spent a lot of time at the Johannesburg Hotel School, which he founded in Auckland Park there, and he loved being with the students and used to visit them every year and speak to them and tell them about what he thought were the things to think about in hospitality. No, I mean, Sol was in South Africa all the time. He, in fact, spent probably the last 8 months of his life in Cape Town at Leeukoppie, which is his home. And that was sadly where he passed away, surrounded by his family and his friends, but his family particularly, of course. And he was buried yesterday in Cape Town. And the family were present. I think, everyone is very aware of this awful COVID-19 pandemic, and the family didn't want to do anything irresponsible, so they kept the family funeral very private. Just the family were involved to not expose anybody to the risks of large gatherings.
But even on his passing, he didn't go out without a little bit of controversy there too. Fake news earlier in the day. How did all of that come about? Yeah.
Look, I don't truthfully know what happened, but I know that Jeremy Mansfield, who I must say was very gracious about it and very apologetic about it. I think he was the first one to post that Sol had passed away on what would have been Friday night, which was wrong. And I don't know how Jeremy got the story. Well, I do, actually. He said he was told it by two very reliable sources. He named the sources to me, and I'm not going to go into that now, but they were clearly wrong. And unfortunately, what happened as a consequence of that was that then the Sun International, the company that Sol founded in South Africa, also published a statement totally in good faith, believing that he had passed, and the story just went out. And we managed to get everyone to withdraw the statements, and then, sadly, he did pass on the night of the Saturday, as you mentioned, just before 7 p.m.
Ian, just to close off with, what did you think about South Africa today? Clearly, in the past, he was one of the hugest supporters. He was a big fan and, I think, friend of Nelson Mandela's. Yeah. What did he make of where we are?
Look, we talked about it a bit. I think he felt that the era of the previous president, Mr. Zuma, was a time that that was very sad for South Africa, that there was a lot of things that were happening that were very bad for the country, and he certainly didn't know how to deal with that. He thought it was a great tragedy. I think in terms of the current leadership, I think he was a great fan of President Ramaphosa. But I think most importantly, what Sol felt was that South Africa had this extraordinary, set of assets, the people who are just naturally hospitable and great ambassadors for the country, the assets, in the geography and the topography and the weather. And he just felt this country had great potential. So I think he was saddened by some of the declines that had happened with the infrastructure and that. But he always used to come back here, and he was a great supporter and a great defender of South Africa on the international markets and with his international friends and acquaintances. He loved South Africa. It was his home. It always would be his home. And in fact, what was interesting as well was that Sol never ever took up citizenship of any other country. He remained a South African. He traveled on a South African passport. That, of course, had its challenges as well, and I was often sorting out those those challenges of getting visas for all sorts of places. But he remained true to South Africa right to the end.
Ian Douglas, a friend and, as you heard, a longtime colleague of the late Saul Curzons. May he rest in peace. David, it is a Jewish tradition, isn't it, that you get buried the next day? And so he died Saturday night. He's buried on Sunday.
Sometimes they'll delay it to wait for members of the family, but they don't like to delay it too long. In fact, in the very religious communities, they bury you almost immediately. You know, literally within an hour or so of you dying, even if it is at night. But that is a tradition. I'm interested to see he was buried in Cape Town. I thought that maybe Johannesburg, you know, where he had been brought up. So that's interesting to hear as well. But I suppose that's where his love was. You know, he was very well. Everybody knew that he loved his homestead in the Cape. You know, there's an interesting story. That Ian brought up about his friends, because I played soccer and I'm still friendly with a man by the name of Hilly Chimes. And old Hilly, when I was playing at Wits, you know, Hilly was he's older than me, and he had met Saul in the army and remained a lifelong friend. And when Saul had a party, whatever it is, he would fly Hilly there, you know, wherever he went. And, you know, to this day, the tragedy, he was a lifelong friend of Hilly's, you know. And Hilly would say, "Oh, I'm going to see Saul." And two different characters, you know. Hilly laid back, successful businessman, but not of Saul's stature. But Saul never forgot him for those few months that they spent in the army together.
It's quite extraordinary that somebody gets to, and Ian made that point as well, that he never forgot his old friends, that someone gets to that level on a global stage. You know, you're rubbing shoulders and sharing jokes with a Frank Sinatra, and then if Hilly were to walk past, you wouldn't ignore him. You'd go and give him a hug too. Absolutely. Well, I suppose not today, but in the past.
But that's what's fascinating, and you know, that's what I always found endearing about Saul, with all his never forgot Hilly, you know, and Hilly was cool about it as well. He was a great chap, Hilly, you know, and just took it in his stride. But they were friends. Whenever I spoke to Hilly and said, "Where did you meet?" "No, we were in the army." And I think in those days it was nothing more than 3 months that you spent together. I don't think it was the 9 months that we had to spend, or a year. So interesting. There were a number of occasions where I would go to presentations by Saul. And the one thing that distinguishes him and distinguishes business leaders is that he was always there in the front. Do you know what I mean? He knew every aspect during the building of Sun City. I mean, every little detail he seemed to have a hand in. And it was a fascinating experience to see the development of it. I think he brought in, and I wish Ian could have been there, I think they brought in some of the Disney designers, you know, the people who designed the Disney theme park. And because a lot of those sculptures are nothing more than polystyrene, you know, covered in a resin, which gave the feeling that these were marble but beautiful, absolutely beautiful places that he built.
Well, it has been a while since I've had the privilege of talking to Delphine Governor at Perpetua, the company that she has founded. In fact, Delphine, how old is Perpetua now?
Hi, Alec. Good to talk to you again. So we are 7.5 years old now. We started managing money in October 2012.
Wow. Time flies.
Eh? Yeah. Mm. It has blown.
And prior to that, you were one of the superstars at Allen Gray, went off and doing your own thing. And in this kind of a market, and we're going to talk about it in a moment, is it more difficult being having your own business rather than having a big brand behind you?
Well, I think that's a good question. Obviously, for companies that are more marginal, you tend to find that, you know, this would be tricky times. Important, though, for, I think, and again, every entrepreneurially run business is going to have different economics. I think the important thing for investment firms is that if you have the right owners, so the right people that own you, and typically they should be investors as opposed to necessarily kind of short-term business owners, they tend to understand that investment businesses are, by their very nature, exposed to good and bad times, and that one can never predict the extent of both a bull run or a bear market. So there's just, you know, the volatility is what you sign up for. profits don't come in a straight line because your top line is totally geared to the level of the market. So having that understanding for any person starting an investment business is almost essential going in. I often think one of the most underestimated or kind of focused elements of investment firms is who owns you, and that they have this key understanding of what you're signing up for.
Well, David Shapiro is with us as well, Delphine. David, have you ever seen in your many years, many decades, certainly many more decades than Delphine and I, a market environment like this? I don't know if you were close enough to 1969 to have...
Oh, wow. Do you want me to list them, Alec? I'm just writing something for tomorrow, and I remember the dark days of 1976. Okay, different story when the Soweto uprising. There were days in which we did not do a deal. We never put a transaction through the stock exchange. So I've lived through many, many difficult times. I came in the aftermath of 1969. I was doing chartered accountancy. But I remember 98, 87, 2000, 2001, 2002, all the wars, the 9/11, 08, 09. I mean, that was a disaster. And as Delphine says, you learn to – this is just part of the journey. So we seem to get one every 6 or 7 years, and you just have to understand it and position yourself properly and just move on.
Delphine, I'm interested to get your take on this, because Hendrik du Toit last week, who you know well, who started what is now 91, Investec Asset Management, he says we as investors should be looking at this as though it's a war, where governments just spend money not worrying about who's going to repay it? That'll come in another day. David was saying yes, he agrees that it is like a war that's going to last 90 days. How are you seeing it?
Well, I think what both the observations by both, obviously, highly experienced people that are seeing it and have experienced more than just kind of 2 or 3 decades, is that is showing you that actually no one knows what the scenarios are going to be. So what we're sitting with is incredible uncertainty. And I think what's hard, and when you ask David, have you seen anything like this before, David? It's always the tricky thing is that why this feels so different. And I mean, I started my investment career as an analyst in March of 1998, so about 22 years ago. And we were just coming into this kind of peak of this, incredible bull market in South Africa. The likes of the Steinhoffs and all of that were listing back then, and then hit our first crisis. But where this one's different is that we've got these two threats. We've got this public health threat, which is very real, and then we've got this economic threat, which is multifaceted because it's the supply side, the demand side, the whole financial system. So why we're not sure and why we're sitting with this uncertainty is that in the response from government, from policy makers, from kind of the war rooms, in every single kind of country and government right now, is trying to address all of these things. When historically, when we've had bubbles burst or event-driven issues, it's typically been constrained to a manageable kind of almost space. And so now we're sitting with a situation where no one can prove or disprove what our worst-case scenario is going to be. We've got no experience of a similar situation, and so we've got no way of predicting an impact. So it could be that absolutely indiscriminate spending is required to, both on the public health side and on the economic side. But we do know we're facing potential scenarios where global growth could be, significantly negative double-digit growth in the next 2 quarters, which would be way worse, for example, than the Great Recession following the GFC. So, yeah, all of these are plausible. And I think that's what we're seeing now, is that this uncertainty has created this massive, massive fog and blur. And so we're all, and the market is really struggling to make investment decisions because of it.
And Mr. Market is completely depressed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think what's happening is that you're seeing that because of trying to work out, who will come through, how will this happen. Mr. Market is in even in the best of times always swinging between the extremes of euphoria which typically is almost unsustainable, and then pessimism, which is often, you know, both unjustifiable and sustainable. And so you have this impatience and this irrationality, and there's, you know, they say, when Benjamin Graham first coined it, he almost said there was like a manic depressive nature of Mr. Market. And so, you know, the problem is, we're supposed to behave as the market is there for us to take advantage of, not in reverse. But as we know, in the short run, the opposite occurs.
What about value investing, Delphine? I know this is your background for looking for stocks that you can buy at a discount. It's value investing has been so out of fashion for so long. Do you think that this could be the transition that makes people look differently at stocks?
Well, I think, you know, it's a very, very, absolutely germane and relevant question, Alec. And it's funny because, you know, you asked when I started our business and it was 2012. And I probably, as a value investor with the benefit of hindsight, couldn't have picked a worse time, because we literally started at a point where value, you know, has gone through this basically 7.5 year, you know, terrible period. And I think what's been so difficult for value in this cycle compared to all previous cycles has been not just kind of the extent of the underperformance, but then how protracted it's been. You know, there's been the odd flash where, you know, certain sectors have done okay, but point to point, the better part of the last decade has been terrible. You know, really where value had its run was just coming out of the GFC. And I think that's the most important point, is to understand, well, when is it that this style of almost, you know, fundamental-driven investing tends to do well? And fortunately, we have quite a few crises that we can look to. And what's interesting, you know, when we look at what happens in bull markets, and in bull markets is when the value style, which tends to be more fundamental-driven, tends to lag. The bull markets, as we've seen them over, you know, the last, say, just 2 or 3 decades, have all been driven by slightly different things. You know, we have the tech boom in the 90s, we had the commodity super cycle, you know, after 2000s, and then more recently, you know, this fang so-called, you know, bull market has been really about platform companies, et cetera. And we've seen how that's transmitted into our markets through the likes of Nasdaq. But bear markets, on the other hand, have this unique correlation. You know, you look at your screens today, and it's as though everything's correlated. You know, South African shares are down over 30%, you know, year to date, resources are down over 40%. Properties are down over 50%. The U.S. market's down over, you know, 30%. The Nasdaq's down slightly less. So you're finding that bear markets are similar. So the question is, does this bode well for fundamental-based investing? And interestingly, we've got the evidence to show that through all these cycles, while value will perform equally poorly as we go into the bear market, as we've seen, coming out of it is where value typically perform significantly better. And so this is why, if you look post kind of the tech bubble bursting, post the GFC, that value style tends to perform significantly better. And that's really because of where value managers tend to position their portfolios. And what happens is that you tend to find that recovery is what really makes those times. So obviously, you know, it might seem like we're talking our book, but we're actually basing it on empirical evidence. And so when we're seeing kind of the absolute valuation that is available, and then the ratio of kind of very expensive shares to very cheap shares, we've had this massive widening. And so things bode well. And I guess the point is that we're dealing with shocks and uncertainty. And when you're in that space, the best almost anchor to use is valuation. So you avoid overvalued shares that are priced for perfection, and you buy assets that are priced for extinction. And you try and do your work to ensure that you don't invest in potentially extinct shares, which are being sold down as though they are going to go extinct.
Which is a segue into Sasol, surely. Today it's just over 20 Rand a share.
Yeah. So, I mean, Sasol's obviously a very tough one, because, you know, any value investing, including ourselves, would have probably not owned it at multiples of the current price, because it would have been extremely expensive. And then as it started coming off, in the last several months, started to look interesting, notwithstanding some of their kind of self-inflicted issues. I think the issue with Sasol right now is, I mean, management did come out last week. And remember, the real trigger event for Sasol is this combination of what has happened to the oil price, post the whole breakdown between OPEC and Russia, and then what that translates to Sasol's kind of own balance sheet, given the level of net debt and how tight its kind of precarious situation is. So the scenario that was not envisaged was that we would be dealing with a $30 or sub-$30 oil price. So Sasol has come out and given the plan to basically, which is a pretty meaty plan, a $6 billion program to reduce net debt. And while the plan seems quite plausible because some of the stuff is quite within their control, for example, delaying expansion capex, environmental capex, etc. So conserving about $2 billion of cash, they seem to be quite well down the path of asset disposal. So and raising about $2 billion and then potentially raising a further $2 billion doing a partnership on their U.S. Chemicals business. The issue we have right now is not necessarily what is within Sasol's control, but this call on the oil price. And so the market is now incredibly jittery because, and it would be true for, I guess, any oil majors who have similar balance sheets, is that the question is how, this current oil price environment continues and is protracted. We'll see, continued well-supplied markets and, terrible demand, which then just means the oil price remains lower. And at some point, and this is so the profitability of the business starts to come under pressure. And I think that's the bigger factor right now that is in investors' minds is really how long will this oil price stay lower?
But isn't the point with Sasol that it's a rand oil price? And if you offset what the rand has been doing, the way the rand has fallen out of bed, it must surely give them some kind of a shield.
Well, this absolutely, and in fact, if you've gone back over long periods of time and you plotted the correlation, it's absolutely the tightest correlation, over long periods of time has been the Sasol share price relative to the rand oil price. So it's been, and that's why it's been always perceived as one of those kind of almost perfect rand hedges in a way for South African investors, particularly. But I think what's been very unique and curious, and I think this is where things have become tough, is that in the last period, particularly in the last 6 to 12 months, that actual relationship broke to some extent. In that Sasol, because of some of its own self-inflicted issues, and we saw, if you're following the journey of Sasol, late last year, it became less of a call on the rand, on the level of the rand, and more of a call on the oil price, and then the business's own kind of own actions. And so we've had a break. I mean, we saw the same thing with Sappi, to an example. So if you were running almost a barbell portfolio, as many fund managers were doing coming into this year, which is buying some of the cheaper SA Inc. that, we thought could withstand, and then trying to add, and hedge that with some, rand hedge, Sasol wasn't proving, to be that kind of perfect rand hedge that it has historically been. So that relationship has broken of late.
So what is your suggestion now to your clients? I'm sure not just clients, family and friends are saying, well, we know that Delphine, this is her game. Let's ask her what to do. Should we be jumping in and buying cheap now? Should we be selling everything? Or should we be sitting on the sidelines waiting for better days?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the question, right? And I think the reality is that what we do know is, because, I mean, we too are invested in the market. We too are invested in funds alongside our clients. Exactly as you say, we're managing indirectly, our family members, pension funds, depending, where they have been employed in the past. So people are scared, people are panicked, and it comes all the way back to the point that I made in the beginning, because we don't know how bad it's going to get. But I think the point is that we need to have something that we can hang our hats on and something that we can say, can we look to see, while this might be a completely different crisis and it might be multifaceted, how can we know historically there was a Great Depression? What worked then? What could we look to saying could work now? And I think the point is that we must remember how the market works. You spoke about Mr. Market and the market, always reacts in advance. So well before something happens, typically the market is that discounting mechanism. And so what the market's telling you right now is that economic, and business conditions are going to get worse. And I think that's now almost consensus. We just don't know how bad. the market's telling you, you know, COVID-19 and coronavirus is going to spread. We don't know where death will peak, but it's going to definitely spread. And the reality is that's what's being priced in. So you look at the prices of banks, retailers, property companies, anything that has, that's, you know, basically anything really, industrial companies, manufacturers. So the question is equally on the opposite end, as we start to see some sort of light at the end of the tunnel, the market and the share prices are going to react on the upside before things actually demonstrate improvement. And so the way we look at it is we say, well, which are the businesses that we think will make it through, that can actually generate cash even under dire kind of top line scenarios, and can generate potentially positive profits, even if they're small and significantly down from the prior year, but not necessarily losses, and can actually self-fund. So can they make it through this period? So have reasonably kind of short balance sheets with an ability to just kind of get through. Because if you can find those businesses, I think you have a massive buying opportunity. As long as you avoid kind of the pockets of overvaluation, avoid the bankruptcy risk. It sounds obvious, but at the same time, we're almost putting too many quite decent companies in the bankruptcy risk basket. And so if we as kind of fundamental investors can work out, well, these ones will survive because now the market is contracted. I think if you can find positive net income, positive operating cash flow, you know, it becomes what you can use as your anchor in a bear market. So we, you know, to the extent our balance funds, for example, have been well below fully invested. So this is when you put your dry powder to work. But with an opportunity of higher grading your portfolio, you have no reason to buy poorer cyclical businesses now, because actually really solid businesses, which are typically ungeared, are trading on way more depressed multiples. So this is the time to kind of to take advantage. The preface, though, is that we know things can get worse, but what we're not trying to do is time it. We know that there can be temporary declines further in share prices, and you can perhaps average down even lower as you purchase. What we're trying to do is look through it to say, well, where are the sustainable earnings looking through this? Because we know the market will respond sooner than when the actual kind of improvement is revealed.
Delphine Govender, the founder of Perpetua, with, as always, lots of common sense. David?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was, when we were talking earlier, I said that the shock value is out of the market now. We know what lies ahead, and markets will start to look ahead. And that's why you have to position yourself for where you're going to be in the next 2-3 years. And it's absolutely essential that you get the kind of businesses that are going to survive and prosper during these times. You don't have to, you know, in my view, we don't have to get the turnaround stocks. You don't have to look at Sasol and say, you know, is it a gamble? You know, is it going to come out of this downswing? Why? There's so many other options available to you that you don't have to make that kind of, you know, those kind of choices. So personally, that's exactly what I'm doing here sitting at my desk now, is trying to work out where we should be placing, you know, where we should be placing our clients' money. You know, I see another aspect of it. I'm very big into tech, as we were talking about earlier. I still think that tech companies have got so much cash on their balance sheets, and therefore can sustain research and development. They can sustain CapEx without even selling a product. The other story is that there's going to be a big swing towards health. In the same way as in 08 and 09, we did stress testing on banks, we're now going to start doing stress testing on healthcare systems, whether hospitals can cope, because that's what's behind the whole COVID-19, is the worry that hospitals will be overwhelmed. This is an area we've ignored. There's been so much pressure on pharmaceutical companies to cut back because of their overpricing. I think all of those issues are now going to subside, and a lot more liberal attitude will be taken towards that. So plenty of places to look for in the next couple of years.
Well, David, we've been talking a theme, if you like, over the last few weeks about this switch, this transition to tech, and the way that if you are going to be investing, do look for those companies that can take advantage of the fourth industrial revolution, the new world, because if nothing else, COVID-19 is probably going to push us in that direction.
I think even more so. You know, we were already moving towards the data economy, however you want to explain it, fourth industrial revolution. And I think if anything, I think what we've learned through this COVID-19, from people staying at home, from people not learning at home, from people doing business at home, yes, we need people. You know, we can't completely isolate ourselves, but I think things are going to change dramatically in favor of businesses that are positioning themselves correctly.
We're going to Durban now to meet James Lees. He's got a company called AdvantageLearn.com. James, what is it that you guys do?
Hi, Alec. Hi, David. Thanks for having me on your show. What we do is we're a company that's passionate about making sure that learners are going to become agents in the fourth industrial revolution. So 4IR, not objects. So what we've been focusing on in the last couple of years is really producing resources and starting producing resources that are going to enable learners to become agents in 4IR. And so we've focused predominantly into maths first, mathematics training. So we've got advanced math programs. We've got mathematics solutions from grade 8 to grade 12. And then we've also tried to help South African learners get access to the right degree programs that they need through national benchmark test preparation. But we've really been passionate from about 2015 on trying to do this in a scalable way online.
So specializing in high school maths?
Yes, correct. We currently focus into high school.
And how do you do that? How do you actually help people? Clearly, we teed you up because we spoke about online, but you would do it in a different way to the classroom environment.
Yeah, so one thing that we realized a couple of years back is that we realized, you know, there was a lot of kind of doom and gloom with the South African education system and all the rest. And we all know and are aware of the challenges that we have. But what we actually realized was that, you know, we have some of the best educators in the world, arguably in the world. And it was really just a question of access. We thought, well, one way we can try and help this is by simply capturing these educators in video form and then trying to deliver them via web technologies and different accessible technologies as the technology stack kind of evolves and grows, so that, you know, students can get access to these top class educators, because that's one of the core challenges, is just really getting access to that knowledge, access to that educator. And so that's really where we thought we could start. So we started with maths, and we took a very experienced educator, Trish Pike, who was been at many of the private schools in South Africa, and Johannesburg St. Vivians and Kersey and Thomas More in KZN. We said, right, Trish, we're gonna produce your material. And that's how we kind of started it.
And how many videos or tutorials do you have?
So for our mathematics solution from grade 8 to grade 12, we've got over 2,000 learning videos. We've really been mindful of how we produce those videos in as short as possible, but as long as necessary type form. And so they're not too long where learners would get bored or lose focus. With that, we've also focused on building what we call test your understanding. So we follow a very simple pedagogy, and that's just learn, practice, assess, and just repeating that kind of model and through repetition. We've got about over 2,000 at the moment.
And how well are they accessed?
In terms of numbers of students?
Yeah.
So they access pretty well. It could be a lot larger in terms of getting numbers onto our platform. But we are at the beginning of our journey in that. I mean, we've had the solution finished from about mid-2018. So it's really not that old. But they are being, the usage that we're seeing from learners is what's incredible. When they do come online onto our platform, they really are seeing enormous benefits. And we get some really great, some great data from that to kind of show their progression as they go through and get better at their subject.
And that is the whole story, you know, opening it up. Once someone's tested, we've seen it on our side with webinars, for instance. When somebody who's used to doing presentations and all the hassle factor that goes with it suddenly discovers there's a webinar at a fraction of the cost, they jump in. And I guess that would have been part of the motivation for you to do your COVID-19 bit and opening up your platform to anyone for free during this period?
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, we talk about it at AdvantageLearn.com about this mental hurdle that is around kind of online learning. And some people have made that jump earlier. You know, the early adopters, they've jumped over it quite early, and others are kind of, you know, get onto it more gradually. And with COVID-19, I think, you know, there's two kind of positive benefits for us here at Advantage Learn. I mean, it was really sincere in our approach. We really did want to help. We knew that learners would have a big challenge, and educators as well, just being, you know, continuing their learning during this time. And so we really thought we could help there and moved on that. But then it also is about, you know, helping people get over that mental hurdle to online learning.
And obviously very South African focused. Do the different provinces still write different exams now?
No. So the two main systems of education at the high school level at the moment are obviously you've got the state DBE and then the IEB. But both follow the CAPS curriculum, and they are focused, all the education systems are focused on the NSC exam in a grade 12 level. And now they are starting to think about introducing something called the GEC at a grade 9 level. So those are the main kind of testing points, is at a grade 9 level and then at a grade 12 level, and all the provinces follow the same, except all right, for the international curriculum.
So the point here is that the parents who are listening to this and have got their loved ones at home now because the school's closing and so on, they can go push them towards AdvantageLearn.com and your website, in other words, and they'll be able to access tutorials on maths and become maths whizzes during the next few months when they're kept at home. In other words, they can't just sit there and twiddle their thumbs.
Exactly. It's a great time to actually improve your maths while you don't have to like rush through the syllabus in the school environment. So yeah, we need the mathematicians clearly to become, you know, to protect us from whatever the future throws at us. So get learning.
James Lees is from AdvantageLearn.com. Isn't that a nice story, Dave?
And it kills me, you know, that because I loved maths and science at school. I mean, listen, I matriculated, I can't even remember, back in the 60s and that. You know, Alec, we had teachers who were so old and so bored, you know, and you set your sights on getting 60 or 70%. That was about the best, you know, that you could do with those kind of teachers. And when you see what's available to kids today, I mean, it's so enthralling. And therefore, anybody who does want to learn has access to these, you know, incredible teachers and programs and that, you know, and that I apply even through my university career. Boy, So things have changed for the benefit. I think I need my life again.
Well, who knows? Maybe there's some people who say you will have another life, David. And I look forward to broadcasting with you in that life as well. Although this time we'll just stay away from television. I think we'll just keep doing the radio stuff. Well, Dave, as always, good to have you through the program today. It worked okay. I mean, it's better when we're in studio, but we certainly have been nicely connected. Fascinating stories. And I think just this last one, before we part, James's point there, that when people, it's a little bit like a really good curry. If you don't know what curry is, well, you'd ignore it and you might even diss it. But when you do taste it, you realize that there's a whole new world out there that you can start experimenting with. And I guess with online education and learning and absorbing, it is something that is very different for many people. But my goodness, once you've tasted it, whew.
It is, and you reach such a wide audience. You know, and I think that's the beauty about this. You know, even talking about the webinars, you're reaching people that you could never reach before by simple invitation. So I find this all very exciting.
Whole new world for us, yeah. Well, this has been Rational Radio on this latest episode, 23rd of March. Thanks for being with us. Don't forget that we have a brand new daily podcast, Inside COVID-19, which we'll be running for as long as it takes, which will keep you up to date in the world's war with the viruses and germs that came from that awful wet market in Wuhan. We look forward to being back in your company with Rational Radio and same time, same place next week. But please don't forget to keep updated on COVID-19 by coming on to BizNews, and you can download that podcast, or indeed subscribe to it in the same way as you subscribe to this one. I'm Alec Hogg. Until the next time, cheerio.